From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. The coronavirus has local hospitals and public health officials on alert.
There's no question it will put stress on the healthcare system, and this is something that probably we will have to all accommodate.
We'll talk about how Massachusetts is preparing. We'll recap the wild Democratic debate in South Carolina last night, including your calls.
Let's talk about
Let's
math.
Talk
indeed.
About math.
Okay,
if
so here's the
nothing,
math. No, here's the math.
Can I respond
doing
to the
nothing
attack?
Is what
Excuse
will
me,
happen.
Senator Sanders, you're allowed a quick response, and then we would like to allow the other
candidate. Moderator, guys.
Senator Sanders.
Moderator. Is it my turn?
Plus, author and activist Diane Ravitch on public education.
The real issue is not how do you hold teachers accountable, how do you hold schools accountable, but how do you hold the state accountable for doing what's right?
Call us. It's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The coronavirus seems to be on everyone's mind today. In fact, 30 seconds ago, MSNBC, CNN, and Fox News were all reporting on coronavirus. Hundreds of new cases are popping up around the world. We earlier had a total of 15 confirmed cases in the U.S. CNN, just a few seconds ago, was reporting 60 cases in the United States. The worries have even hit Wall Street. So we have some basic questions. How worried should we actually be? How do we prepare? We thought you might have them, too. So to help us answer them, John Auerbach is on the line from Washington, D.C. He is the president and CEO of Trust for America's Health and the former Massachusetts Commissioner for Public Health. He's also the former associate director for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. John, welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. A pleasure to be on the call.
So, you know, sometimes the first question to ask is, how big a deal is it?
Well, it's potentially a very big deal. I mean, we need to monitor this very carefully, but clearly the virus is spreading and spreading quite rapidly, and we're also monitoring how serious the illness is that people get when they get infected, and also how many people die. So what we're seeing so far is it's a serious pandemic and one that requires a lot of thought and planning.
So you said it's potentially a big deal. What are the signals or the tipping point that listeners are looking for when the word potentially drops out of that sentence? Do you understand what I'm asking you?
Sure. Well, what has happened so far is that the virus is clearly spreading around the country, and we've seen the number of cases in the United States increase as well. But in the United States, it's still a low number of cases, and steps are being taken to contain it. Now, that may not be possible. Once it's no longer possible to contain the spread of the illness, once it's clearly reach the general public, then we reach a much different stage. Then we have to prepare.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, John. Who makes that decision? Who's the one that says, okay, this has reached the general public? Is there someone who will say that at some point, or is it just going to be a consensus moment?
I think there will be a continual information and update that come from the Centers for Disease Control. I think they will be nationally the experts with regard to what stage we're at. But I think it will be quite apparent, because I think at the point that we move from a relatively small number, like the number we have now, if we get to the point where we start to see very large leaps in terms of those who are confirmed, and we see many more states that have cases. Currently, we only have 7 states that have cases. But if we begin to see those numbers rapidly increase, I think it will be obvious. But the confirmation will come from the CDC, if not from the president.
So it's really rate of growth and sort of penetration across the states in the United States.
That's right. I mean, we see in the seasonal flu what widespread infection can occur. Even though it's very widespread in the United States, we take precautions against the seasonal flu. We tell people to wash their hands, to stay home if they're sick, and because there's a vaccine, we tell them to get vaccinated. So even if it spreads throughout the population, which we're not ready yet to say will happen, there are clearly important steps that can be taken for people to protect themselves.
So to that point, what should Massachusetts be doing to prepare, and what should people in Massachusetts be doing?
Well, the residents of Massachusetts are very fortunate because both with the leadership of the governor and with the leadership of the state public health department, there are experts who have been through infectious disease outbreaks of a serious nature in the past, including H1N1, the risks that we experienced with Ebola and Zika. So there are very highly skilled people who are already planning now at the Department of Public Health and in other places within the state government to take the necessary steps to prepare.
So, you know, a lot has changed in the last 24 hours. It feels like we've reached kind of this moment of crisis is not the right word, but certainly a different level of attention to it. As recently as a couple of weeks ago, you know, the predominant message was, hey, the flu is worse. You know, this is wait and see. Was that the right message a couple of weeks ago, given where we are now? Or should we have been more proactively blowing whistles and preparing before this?
I think the messages that were coming from the scientific experts in the United States at the CDC and the NIH were the right messages. They were saying, let's not get ahead of ourselves in terms of understanding the virus, the level of infectivity, the level of illness, how it spread. They were saying, let's make sure that we are paying attention to what we know versus what we fear. Clearly, a lot has been learned in the last few weeks about the nature of the virus, but also we've seen it spread rapidly. And so now it is appropriate, as CDC has recently said, that we consider the likelihood of spread throughout the United States to be inevitable. And that means we should kick up the level of preparedness to a higher level. That requires resources, which is why the debate in Washington is currently occurring about just how much money needs to be allocated now for states and locals to be ready.
So, John, in the last 10 to 20 seconds, the president will have a press conference this evening on this. What would you want the country to hear from the president?
I would want to hear that he has placed the direction of our response in the hands of the people who were the experts, the scientific experts, the medical experts at the CDC and the NIH. They know best how we should be fighting this kind of a pandemic. And I would hope he not only gives them the direction, but pledges to them that the resources necessary will be delivered to them and to states and locals so that they can respond.
Okay, we will continue to watch and follow this. That is John Auerbach, President and CEO of Trust for America's Health and the former Massachusetts Commissioner for Public Health, also a former Associate Director for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. There's more coming up. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Wow, last night in Charleston, South Carolina, seven Democratic presidential candidates clashed in a messy, raucous, arguably pretty contentious debate in their final meeting before the state's primary on Saturday. In a moment, we're going to talk about all of it and take your calls. But first, some political news closer to home. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders plans to hold rallies in Massachusetts this weekend, too. Joining us now to talk about that is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, welcome.
Hi, Tiziana.
All right. So Sanders is campaigning in Massachusetts. There are 14 states voting next Tuesday. He's
right.
Going to be here twice. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, right? He's going to be campaigning in Springfield on Friday and Saturday right on Boston Common. And what do I make of it? I think he senses a chance to score a victory on Elizabeth Warren's home turf. And, you know, this announcement by the Sanders campaign follows a recent UMass Lowell poll that found Sanders and Warren in a virtual tie for first place. This was just last week. And if you're the Warren campaign, this is troubling. I mean,
it's a big deal.
It's a huge deal. I mean, if Sanders is in contention in Massachusetts, it's a big deal for Warren. If Sanders wins in Massachusetts, it's an enormous deal for the Warren campaign. You know, she's still looking for her first win since these early contests have begun, or at least, you know, some way to revive her campaign and make a case that she's viable. And if on Super Tuesday, Massachusetts goes into Sanders' column, that's really dire for her.
All right. So given the existential nature of this, how is her campaign and how is she responding?
Well, I mean, I think Warren's supporters were buoyed by her strong performance last week in Las Vegas. I know you guys are going to be talking about how she did in the debate last night. Lots of money flowed in after the debate. That's compelling. She's also making a case that something like 147 state and local and city officials have endorsed her. And clearly she's got a lot of support here in Massachusetts. So that's what the campaign is focusing on. And we're going to know soon enough how that plays out.
All right. Before we let you go, because we are going to turn to the debate analysis in a minute. But I mean, you've been doing this a long time. You have seen a lot of debates. Last night was interesting. I'd really love to just get sort of your headline take, your reaction to what you saw last night.
Yeah, I was watching mud wrestling and a debate broke out, I guess, to borrow a Rodney Dangerfield line. I don't know. I was disappointed with the moderators because I'd almost felt like, I mean, to go back to Rodney Dangerfield, it almost felt like a hockey game where they were like standing back and sort of saying, hey, folks, this is part of the entertainment. I thought it was a mess. It was truly a mess. But it also pointed to the stakes. I mean, so many people had so much to prove. This is sort of do or die for Joe Biden in South Carolina. There was that issue. There was Bernie Sanders as the front runner taking hits from everybody. There was the continuing Warren trying to dismantle Bloomberg for obvious reasons. So there was a lot going on. This was everybody's last chance before Super Tuesday to reach a big audience. And I think that's what you heard and saw in that sound and noise and fury last night.
All right. Well, we will be following along with you over the next week or so. That's Anthony Brooks, WBUR senior political reporter. I appreciate you making the time, Anthony.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, as Anthony said, it was wild. It was crazy. It was messy. It was South Carolina last night.
My entire career has been wrapped up in dealing with civil rights and civil liberties.
As Democrats, we need to speak to the future we can build together.
The answer is for us to break the corporate stranglehold on our government and have the government work for the people again.
And I think having someone that keeps their promises and follows through and is going to get things done for this people matters. And that's why.
The time has come for us to stop acting like the presidency is the only office that matters. Not only is this a way to get Donald Trump reelected, we got a house to worry about.
Let me finish. If you keep on going, we will elect Bernie. Bernie will lose to Donald Trump. And Donald Trump and the House.
I'm hearing my name mentioned a little bit tonight. I wonder why.
Is it bad that I'm so psyched to have the conversation with the two of you? This is going to be fun, y'all. So here to break it down with us is Susan Tracy. She's a Democratic strategist, president of the Strategy Group. Thanks for being with us. And Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and CEO of Verdant Medical, a Massachusetts medical and recreational cannabis company. Tito, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And we want you to be a part of it, too. Pull up a chair. Let's talk about this. Did you watch the debate? What'd you think? Did anything change your mind? Do you think differently today than you did before you saw that last night? Do you know who you're going to vote for next Tuesday? Join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Susan, what's your big headline from last night?
Well, I actually think I agree with Anthony. I think the moderators should have done a better job at moderating that debate. So I keep finding myself thinking, can't you turn the mics off? You know, if you have a minute 30 to answer. So that's one side. You know, just the whole chaos of the debate, I think, was really a management of the debate issue. I think if I looked at what the takeaways were, I think the stakes were probably highest last night for Joe Biden. And, you know, could Joe Biden survive that race? Because if he doesn't win in South Carolina, I think it's probably the end of his campaign. I think he did survive. I think he did a good job. And I think if you were a voter who thought, I want to vote for Biden, but I'm not sure, I think he gave you some assurance like, That's a good vote to cast. That's my gut.
So I want to listen to a little sound before we get Tito's reaction, because I feel like this both captures the chaos of last night, but also the way people were jockeying to come out on top. Let's listen to some sound here.
Let's talk about
Let's
math.
Talk about math.
Okay,
if
so here's the math.
Nothing,
no, here's the math.
Can I respond to the attack?
Doing nothing is what
Excuse
will
me.
Happen.
Senator Sanders, you're allowed a quick response, and then we would like to allow the other
people. Moderator, guys.
Senator Sanders.
Moderator. Is it my turn?
So you have like four layers going on there. This is about details. Audiences booing. People yelling over each other. No one can tell whose turn it is. Tito.
The Rumble in the Jungle. The Thriller in Manila and Charleston.
I love it.
I love WWF and WWE. This was the Royal Rumble, but they didn't actually have an official ref in the room. So I guess I absolutely agree with my colleague that Joe Biden survived this.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's actually buoyed by Representative Clyburn's support of him.
A prominent African-American elected official in South Carolina who endorsed him today.
Yes, which is a great thing. I kind of look at this thing as king of the hill or king or queen of the hill.
Interesting.
Bernie's on top. And right, you have to, and it's much harder to kind of get up there. He has some leverage down. I think Elizabeth has thrown, Senator Warren has actually thrown Bloomberg off the mountain several times over. And people are kind of jockeying to get up that hill. I don't believe there was a change in terms of where people stand. I think mm-hmm. there's a top tier, kind of middle tier that's being jockeyed around. And you're right. I believe that this is a huge state for Joe Biden and really will determine whether or not he continues
Absolutely.
On.
Yeah. So, Susan, you know, building on what Tito just said, going into the debate last night, mm-hmm. I was pretty sure that the person with the target on their back was Bernie Sanders. And we even heard in that montage at the beginning where he said, I'm hearing my name come up a lot tonight. By the end of the debate, I'm not convinced. I thought he was the one that took the most number of hits. Was he the one with the target on his back? And was that effective for the other candidates? Because it kind of felt like Mike Bloomberg wound up in people's sights.
Well, I do think Bernie had a target on his back. I think everyone went after him, except for Warren to some extent. She went a little bit, but went lightly. I think, you know, you'd have to and she went after Bloomberg the hardest. Let's be clear about that.
And we'll come back to that.
Right. So I do think Bernie had a target on his back. I think he was rattled. I don't think he was knocked down, but I think he was rattled.
You think he was rattled?
I do. I think he was rattled last night.
Cuba.
I do. I think he was rattled last night and healthcare. I think there were a couple of moments where he was really pushed hard. As I said, I don't think he got knocked down, but I think there are some cracks there that, you know, could become larger as this campaign goes on. But I think the, you know, significant attack on Bloomberg really comes from Warren.
So that's really interesting. You know, Anthony was saying just a couple of minutes ago the existential battle that Warren and Sanders could be in. And you just said, you know, she pushed more on Bloomberg than Sanders. This was about the hardest she pushed on Sanders, and it was really in the debate.
Bernie and I agree on a lot of things, but I think I would make a better president than Bernie. And the reason for that is that getting a progressive agenda enacted is going to be really hard, and it's going to take someone who digs into the details to make it happen.
Tito, is that enough?
I don't know that it's enough, but I think what she gets to say that this consumer board that she put forward that post the banking crisis, that she was actually able to get something done. I think, but the difficulty is for Democrats in this last six, seven years, it's been pretty tough to get anything done across the board. And so I think I think it's a compelling statement, but I don't believe that shifts people over. And I think it speaks to the difficulty that Elizabeth Warren has with Bernie to her left. And then you have people who are, you know, riding the hell out of the middle lane,
mm-hmm.
right? And
mm-hmm.
and really trying to pull people over to that side. And then with her going along with the Medicare for All and then kind of coming back and saying, hey, we have to have some implementation criteria, I think it makes it a really difficult ride for her in making that assertion.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation, which we want you to do. Pull up a chair at the table. Katie's on the line from Newton. Katie, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was really interested in the crowd's reaction last night to the debate. It really struck me as incredibly amplified, more so than other debates, and in particular around Bloomberg, Liz, and Bernie. I felt like there were there was such an amazing cheering section for Bloomberg almost, and it really kind of took me by surprise. And conversely, I felt like Liz and Bernie got a ton of negative reaction, like very loud, audible negative reaction from the crowd. And you know, I think my only takeaway and my only rationale for this was that it reflects the real sentiment of the country, which is that they're hoping for, you know, a more moderate center of the lane candidate. And I just couldn't tell if that was other people's read or okay. if I'm way off base or what people made of it.
So let me illustrate it. And then, Susan, I'm going to come to you. So this is an exchange with Mike Bloomberg and Bernie Sanders. Listen to the crowd.
Mayor Bloomberg, I'll let you respond to that. Do you think Senator Sanders' economy would be better for America than President Trump?
I think that Donald Trump thinks it would be better if he's president. I do not think so. Vladimir Putin thinks that Donald Trump should be president of the United States. And that's why Russia is helping you get elected, so
Mr.
you'll
Bloomberg.
Lose to him.
And then Bernie Sanders in response.
Hey, Mr. Putin. If I'm president of the United States, trust me, you're not going to interfere in any more American elections.
Okay, and the crowd after that's like, wah! So what to make of that?
I don't know that there's a lot to make of it, to tell you the truth. I think that, as I understand it, because I know there was some talk about who's in the crowd and did they sell seats. As I understand it, every campaign got the same number of tickets and they were allowed to have a section of their own supporters. What I would say is, in some ways, it doesn't surprise me that the crowd would react to Bernie and Warren, because they're the most – think about Pete Buttigieg, very steady. You know, hardly one you're going to jump out of your seat for, right? Mm-hmm. Amy Klobuchar, very steady. Tom Steyer, pretty steady. So, you know, getting a crowd reaction to Bernie and Elizabeth and Biden – they're the kind of big, boisterous ones in the group.
And that's fair, but either to you or Tito, I will admit that there were a number of times while I was watching last night where I was thinking, I don't remember this kind of booing and cheering. I watched a lot of debates this year, and that felt different to me. Am I wrong?
No, I think it was a really energized crowd. But I think we're right before Super Tuesday. The stakes are so much higher. People are so much more excited. And I don't actually yet get to do this for a living, but they're like the people who are in these rooms are the folks who really, really nerd out on this type of thing, right?
Yeah.
So I think you felt that energy in the room, and some of it was kind of like, ooh, I guess cafeteria-like when it came to kind of pointing the finger at someone.
And don't you think you also got that because of what we talked about earlier, which is it wasn't moderated in a way that was controlled.
That is true. So it was a free-for-all.
I think that falls into the audience, too.
Okay, so I want to take a minute now because one of the people I enjoyed following on Twitter most last night was, I think he would refer to himself as former Republican Tom Nichols. He is on the phone with us now. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. He also teaches at the Harvard Extension School. And we do try to bring a Republican voice into this analysis because there are people watching who are going to vote in the general election. So let's give Tom a couple of minutes here. Tom, you were certainly sort of dialing up the exclamation points on Twitter last night. What was your reaction to the debate?
Well, first, let me jump in and, of course, start by saying I don't represent the Naval War College, and I am a former Republican. A couple of things. First, I just want to pile in with everybody else and say that was one of the worst moderated debates I've ever seen. The questions were terrible. The moderators lost control early. There was a lot of – I am not a big fan of Mike Bloomberg, but the animus among the moderators for Bloomberg was obvious and distracting. And what I thought by the end of it is that if the Democrats don't get serious about basically thinning this herd, I mean, I think this is really has to come down to sort of Biden versus Bernie and then let the Democrats decide how they want to go with this. Donald Trump is going to be president again. And
is the field too big right now, Tom, in your mind?
It's been too big from the get-go, and Tom Perez deserves a lot of the blame for this.
He's the head of the Democratic National Committee. Sorry,
yes,
go ahead.
And it really struck me that, you know, people like, you know, Michael Bennett and Steve Bullock and others were pushed off the stage while at the very end we were still having to deal with Andrew Yang and Tulsi Gabbard. And, you know, I mean, it's just the rules were kind of crazy and weeded out people with experience in favor of people who were kind of good at being on the internet.
Tom, that sounds exactly like the Republican side in 2016.
Yes, and this is why the former Republicans and the Never Trumpers are pleading with the Democrats, don't do what we did. Yeah. Don't make the same mistakes we did, because the difference between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders is that Donald Trump has a cult behind him. He has people that are going to show up. Bernie Sanders is going to divide your party, and I think you're going to end up losing to Donald Trump. But I think people like, for example, Elizabeth Warren is making exactly the mistake that Ted Cruz made, which is, I won't attack the most extreme guy standing next to me, because when he somehow fades, I'm going to pick up his voters. And that'll be, you know, that'll be my lane. I think everybody going after Bloomberg, sure, it makes sense. But again, it tells you something about how dysfunctional this primary was, that a party that has sworn to get money out of elections had two billionaires on the stage who bought their way into the debate, when governors and senators and Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and other people had been wiped out early on. There's something very wrong with this primary, and it's going to produce, I think it's probably going to produce Bernie Sanders, unless Biden kind of pulls a rabbit out of his hat in the next few days.
So,
and it's going to be a disaster.
Tom, I want to pull a quote that Tom Steyer had from the debate last night, talking about the challenge of the Democratic Party. And unfortunately, I think the team thought I was going to a different cut. So this is one where Steyer talks about the challenge for the Democrats if there's a... Yeah, let's go.
We are looking at a party that has decided that we're either going to support someone who's a Democratic socialist or somebody who has a long history of being a Republican.
So, Tom, can you stay on the line?
Sure.
Okay. Tito and Susan, your reactions, because you were both nodding and hands were going up and there was all kinds of reactions.
I think we like former Republicans.
I agree with everything you've said. I think my question would be, how do you do it? How do you do it at this stage of the game?
Well,
if what we're saying is we need to whittle this field down and have it be a Biden and Bernie race, how do you do that? The problem that we've run into is that we have a number of candidates who can keep money coming in, can keep raising, who it's not easy for them to simply drop off. So how do you get there? And, you know, I'd ask if you were running the Republican race 4 years ago, what would you have done with Cruz and Kasich and Rubio? And how would you get there?
I can tell you what I would have done with Trump and that I think you should have done with Bernie. I think if you're running a national party, the first criterion is that you actually have to be a member of that party.
Yep.
I argued early on, you can take a look at things I wrote, tweets and articles that I wrote that said the Republican Party should just, as they did with David Duke and others, say, look, Donald Trump's not a Republican. If he wants to run third party, let him run third party. I think one of the ways this field should have been culled a year ago is to say, look, if you want to run in Democratic primaries and be on our stage, you actually have to, join the Democratic Party.
Let's grab a caller on this. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Brian from Natick, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. So I watched it with, I'm originally from the Midwest. I have a lot of family still in the Midwest who are Republicans. I also have a lot of friends in Republican circles. And unfortunately, I think what comes across in these debates is with Bernie, the more emphatic he is with pushing his message, I think the reason that the party is pushing, you know, Bernie's as kind of the front runner is that he's able to energize a base that's as radical as almost what the base was for Trump. And I think the party is thinking, we're going to be able to energize this base that's going to have this huge swell, you know, take over the country and want Bernie to be president and push him forward to be able to beat Trump. The problem is that that base is mostly on the East and West Coast. Well, you already lost the election,
right,
even though you had more votes in those areas. That message from Bernie and the people to the left doesn't resonate with the moderate Republicans or the middle Democrats in the Midwest.
Let's pick it up from there, Brian. Thank you. Tito, what do you think?
But I think one of the things that people are underestimating about Bernie, and I do think when we speak about cult followings and people who are able to fill stadiums and get the energy going, this moderation component, it's cold in a lot of these places. You got to knock on doors and get people pulled out. I believe that there's a groundswell of people who are going to rock out for Bernie. In addition, I don't know if you guys hear this, but I hear a lot of libertarians who actually are Bernie fans.
Interesting,
right? And so there are folk who are on that kind of edge. I also believe, and I think Tom brought it up, the fact that billionaires can buy their way into the Democratic primary side of things, when there are, in particular, people of color who've been pushed out, I think that speaks to where we are as a party. And it's very, very problematic, and we've allowed it to happen. So I think the question is, how do we get back together, and whether or not people can galvanize around one candidate? Because the real issue, the reason why we're here, is none of these candidates have knocked us off our feet. We come time and time again, and we determine Klobuchar was able to do really well in New Hampshire because of the closing
right
that she gave
in Nevada.
Nevada.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, Tom, go ahead.
Can I just make a point here from the other side of the bleachers, which is, this notion that Bernie is going to energize new voters. First of all, that didn't happen in New Hampshire. It didn't happen in Iowa. This is, a kind of selling point by Sanders, when in fact he's been losing votes since 2016. But the bigger problem is he energizes people that are less likely to show up in the first place. And there's a second problem here, which is that I think that a Sanders nomination is a permission slip for a lot of people who are willing to walk away from Donald Trump, or at least to kind of be neutral. See, the notion that you're going to convert Trump voters is wrong. That I have argued against anybody who thinks that's possible. You don't convert a cult. But I think Bernie ends up depressing at least some of the Democratic turnout, because remember, you're only trying to win back 4 or 5 states. It doesn't matter if you pull in an extra 5 million votes in California.
So, well, I'm going to jump in here, Tom. I don't have time to go to another call, but we have a caller who is saying, lifelong Democrat, after last night, I'm disgusted and I want to vote third party. And then we had somebody who came in on Twitter, Sean Connolly, saying, my plan is to vote for Sanders, but I didn't watch the debate last night for my own mental health. I feel like I made the right choice. So, Susan, let me turn to you. What needs to happen? Okay, so we are where we are as a country.
Yep.
The candidates in the Democratic Party are where they are. What needs to happen now for a viable Democratic nominee to come forward and have a chance in the general election?
Well, I think watching what happens with Biden this weekend is really important. I do think that if Biden wins, I think you could see some coalescing around his candidacy. I do. Because what I have found in everybody that I talk to who's a Democrat is what really drives most people is which candidate can beat Trump. And that is, and in some ways, I feel like that's created some of the chaos. I think people aren't willing to commit to anybody because all they care about is beating Trump. So I think, I do think a Biden victory does change things. I think if Biden does not win this week, I think Bernie takes off. And I think the other thing we'll learn on Super Tuesday is just how much money does matter. Because I think if Bloomberg is able to do well in those 14 states, we will tell ourselves that money indeed is critical.
All right. That's Susan Tracy. She's a Democratic strategist and president of the Strategy Group. Thank you, Susan.
Absolutely.
Also, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and CEO of Verdant Medical. Thanks, Tito.
Thank you.
And Tom Nichols on the phone, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College and professor at the Harvard Extension School. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for being with us, callers. Stay tuned. We're going to talk about education when we come back. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts, as a commonwealth, is passionate about education. That's taken a number of forms over the years. Pretty heated debate over a ballot question on charter school caps in 2016 being the most recent example. My next guest argues in her latest book that the education reform movement of the last 20 years, ones that I would argue she characterizes as being of privatization, charter schools, and a disproportionate focus on standardized testing, has been a failure, and it's time to reinvest in public education. Here with me in Studio 3 is Diane Ravitch. She's a longtime education policy activist, research professor at New York University, and author of the new book, Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. Diane, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Also, to help us through and process Ravitch's arguments, we're joined by Jack Schneider, education professor at UMass Lowell and an historian of education policy. He's also co-host of the education policy-based podcast, Have You Heard? Jack, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to invite you to the table. Join the conversation. Where are we on education in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? What do you love? What needs to be changed? If you're a teacher, we really want to hear from you. You may still be at school, but hopefully classes are done and you can call in. Has your experience in the classroom changed in the last several years? And if so, for better or for worse, what's working? What's not? Call us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. Diane, I'm just going to start by asking you, why'd you write the book?
Well, I wrote the book because I had decided not to write any more books because I've written a lot of them. I too, am a historian of education. And I felt that I had made my arguments enough about the dangers of privatization. But then the West Virginia teacher strike started, and it turned into a movement that rolled across the country from West Virginia to Oklahoma to Arizona to Colorado,
yes.
2018. And the teacher strikes, I think, are not over yet. We'll see more of them. And I began to think, you know, it's not just the teacher strikes, but there have been so many incredible instances of people who had no money standing up to literally to billionaires like the Waltons and Bill Gates and Betsy DeVos. And I have a whole chapter with a list of dozens of billionaires who've decided that public education has to be privatized. So I gathered together the stories of resistance and showed that one person can make a difference. A group of people, a dozen people can make a difference, and they didn't have any money, but they won.
So, Diane, it only makes sense for me to ask you. You were the Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. You were a vocal supporter of privatization. What was the appeal? Obviously, you're not now, but what was the appeal to you then? Why did you originally support it?
I was Assistant Secretary under the first President Bush, and it was 91 to 93. And at that time, the idea of charters was a brand new idea. Vouchers was not even discussed then or barely discussed. But the idea of charters was, well, we'll have private people taking over public schools, and they'll surely do better because the private sector usually does better than the public
sector. And you found that compelling at the time?
I thought, you know, we've never tried this. Let's try it. And we tried it. And it failed. It's failed miserably across the country.
Jack, you're nodding.
Yeah, I'm remembering how these policy debates unfolded, where originally the argument for charter schools was that they would be a kind of experiment. The argument was not that we would replace America's public schools with charter schools. That's something that evolved as the neoliberal argument for market-based education evolved. But originally, there was actually buy-in from folks like Albert Shanker, the union leader, and from a lot of teachers who saw this as an opportunity to engage in experimentation, often led by teachers themselves. And I'm laughing because, you know, that really isn't what we've seen. There certainly are cases of schools where that has been the case. But what we've really seen is a more corporate approach to governance being the sort of more successful approach to charter governance. And there's a future that that this has opened up for us.
Okay, so I do want to be clear. You know, the Commonwealth has litigated the charter school question extensively. We've litigated it extensively here on this show before. You, Diane, have a whole chapter on the 2016 ballot initiative in the book. I will say that it doesn't seem like the conversation is over yet, but I don't want to spend too much time on charter schools because there are some other things in the book that feel less litigated and less talked about that I want to bring forward. Before I do that, calls are filling up fast, so why don't we grab a couple callers, listen to what's on their mind, and then we'll go from there. We've got Muhammad from Worcester. Muhammad, go ahead.
Hi, how are we doing? First of all, I want to say I'm a parent. I'm a Democratic supporter. I'm a public school person. I graduated from school in public school. But I'll say this. Since I graduated high school, which is 20-somewhat years ago, and now a parent, the public schools have asked for money, and they've failed to deliver. And I'll tell you this. The people that benefited from the money is administration for the most part. The bottom line, that kids are going through the system that is not being fixed. People are just tinkering around the edges. And I believe our kids need a better education. And I want to say this about Trump, and I hate Trump. Trump has put this whole thing front and center for Democratic Democratic leaders and educators, because they need to address failing schools. And if they're failing, parents need to have an option.
Okay, there are no options. I'm going to pick it up from there, Muhammad. Several important points there that we will get to. I want to add one other caller voice, and then we'll talk about this. We've got Bill from Draycott on the line. Bill, go ahead.
Hello, I'm a veteran public school teacher. I just wanted to throw in that I hear a lot of talk about money. The previous caller mentioned sometimes a perception that teachers are overpaid. But what's eating that all up, of course, are things like special ed costs and health insurance costs. And we're going to have to spend some money. I see an inability to hire new teachers, and my district is not easy to hire new teachers. And then we do everything possible to discourage them from staying in the field, like giving them a minimal starting salary and loading them down with graduate school,
right,
a lack of supplies and support. I'm done.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. So I do want to build, as Bill pointed out, he and Muhammad, one of the things that was common in their calls was this question of money. Diane, what is the right conversation to be having right now about money and school funding?
I think the important thing to recognize is that we are underinvesting in education. And if you look at the data nationwide, as I did, about half the states today are spending less on schools than they were 10 years ago. So in 2008, Massachusetts just passed a new funding bill, very much needed. It's expensive to educate children. It's expensive to educate children with disabilities. It's expensive to pay teachers a salary that they deserve. And we have not been investing in education. So I think we need much more money in education.
Jack, you're nodding.
I'm nodding because if you adjust for real dollars and if you take into account the fact that every human service-based field has increased in cost over the years, the cost of dentistry has increased over the years, these are not good arguments for disinvesting in public education. There are plenty of ways that we can explain the rising cost. And as Diane just argued, there are actually lots of compelling reasons for investing further in public education. One of the reasons why the cost has gone up over the decades and across the century has been that we are more fairly serving historically marginalized groups. Diane mentioned special education students, but let's also talk about low-income students, African-American students, Latinx students, non-English speaking students. These are students who cost more to educate because we have not spent what we need to as a society to ensure equal opportunity for
them. Okay, I'm going to turn to you on this, Diane. As I do, I want to channel Muhammad again, the caller from Worcester, who was arguing that from his perspective, we have put money into schools and that money has been poorly used and has largely been absorbed in administration. So I want to bring his voice back in because I think he's probably yelling at the radio right now saying, but I said, and I just want to bring that back. You go ahead, Diane.
I think that the larger context is to look at the lives of children in America today. And that is that about half the children in the United States qualify for either a free or reduced lunch. And despite all of the claims about us having a fantastic economy, half the children in this country are poor by federal standards. About 20% of the kids in this country are living in deep poverty. So you have to look not just at what happens in the classroom or whether administrators are paid too much or too little, but why don't children have health care? Why isn't there a clinic that's available to families? Why isn't there adequate nutrition for all new children? It really is about having children arrive at school ready to learn.
So, Diane, I'm not sure that a 50% child poverty rate is the right number, and I'm wondering if maybe one of our producers can check that for us. But I want to pick up on the second part of what you were saying. We had Mayor Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston, here on Monday. We do a regular check-in with him, and we talked deeply about education. And one of the things that we talked about was the systemic level of challenge of students who are young kids and young people who are coming into schools with complex issues that are bigger than what we have historically expected a teacher in a classroom to address. Would you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. I mean, we do have a crisis of mental health issues. There are many children who come to school having been traumatized by violence and just by living in poverty and having really terrible home lives. So all of these things matter. The classroom of today is not like the classroom that I went to many years ago in Houston, Texas, where the kids arrived in school and they had had breakfast and they could count on having dinner and having a home to go to. There are a lot of homeless children, and there's a level of stress and trauma that teachers simply don't know how to deal with.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join the conversation, Lisa, pull up a chair. You're from Brookline. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for having me on. I just first want to say I'm really excited that Diane is going to be speaking tonight in Cambridge at First Parish Church at 7 p.m.
Are you going to be there, Lisa?
I'm going to be there, yep. And I wanted to ask Diane and Jack their thoughts on, we've heard that the State Board of Ed is considering intervening in the Boston public schools. And I want to hear their thoughts on whether they think that's going to be helpful or harmful, or what's the track record of states intervening in public school districts that are supposedly underperforming based on standardized test results.
Thanks, Lisa. And I'm just going to give a little bit of context there. Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, we're expecting a report in the next couple of weeks. The mayor and I talked about this on Monday. And one of the questions is whether their findings will cause the state to choose to intervene in specific Boston public schools. Jack, why don't you take it first?
Sure. I think that the state and anybody who is trying to determine the effectiveness of the schools needs to look beyond standardized test scores. This, of course, will come as no surprise. I am the author of a book called Beyond Test Scores. But for those who don't carefully track this argument, it's important to know that proficiency rates on machine-scored standardized tests track very closely with student demography. And what that means is that standardized test scores often tell us more about students' out-of-school background experiences than they do about the performance of the schools. It should come as no surprise, then, that a district like Boston, which serves a lot of low-income children, a lot of historically marginalized racial groups, a lot of kids who come from non-English-speaking households, that a district like Boston will have lower standardized test scores, even if the schools are just as good. And anybody who has walked through the Boston public schools has likely encountered great teaching, caring adults, in many cases, pretty great facilities, although obviously there are some needed infrastructural improvements, and kids who are having a difference made in their lives.
So, Jack, I'm going to turn to Diane on this because you talk a lot about standardized testing, No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top. You're quite critical of that approach to measuring whether or not young people are learning what they need to learn.
Well, first let me say that there is no record, and Lisa, the caller, asked if there's a track record for state takeovers. There is a track record. I don't know of any that has succeeded. I've heard claims of success, but I know of many, many state takeovers that have been utter failures. Detroit would be one. A state takeover in Tennessee was a disaster, and this has happened in state after state. As for standardized testing, the problem that people need to understand is that standardized tests are normed on a bell curve. And so when they talk about closing the achievement gap, they're talking about a bell curve that's designed never to close.
Right, because there's got to be two tails,
right,
one on each
and
end.
The top half of the bell curve will be dominated by kids from affluent homes, and the bottom half of the bell curve will be dominated by kids with disabilities, kids who don't speak English, kids who are poor. And so it's designed always to have a bottom half. And no matter where you move that bell curve, it will always have a top half and a bottom
half.
That
is really very compelling. So just a couple things quickly. According to the latest census figures, 1 in 6 children live in poverty in the United States. That's 2018. We have a teacher on the line, and I'd like to hear from a teacher. So Bill's calling from Worcester. Bill, please go ahead.
Hi. So my thought was about, you know, how money is being spent and what's being taught. If I asked anybody on the air right now to solve a quadratic equation using the quadratic formula, no one would be able to do it. Why is it being taught? Why is money being spent on such skills?
Okay, great. Thank you, Bill. So we have 1 minute, 30 seconds left on the entire show. Diane, in response to Bill, are we teaching the right things in our classrooms?
I think we're testing the wrong things. We're testing children. And I've looked at eighth grade math tests. I could not pass an eighth grade math test today, although I took a lot of math in high school. So yes, there are a lot. We have raised the level of rigor to almost to make children fail.
And Jack, in the last 20 seconds or so. What's the last big question we're not asking that we should be asking right now about education?
What are the costs that we have paid and that we will pay as a society in return for our narrow focus on standardized test scores in two subject areas? What are our kids being denied in terms of the processes of education that they will not be exposed to? And what are the kinds of outcomes that those kids will see given this laser-like focus on test scores?
I really appreciate you both coming in. That was Jack Schneider, professor and historian of education policy at UMass Lowell, and Diane Ravitch, research professor. Jack, thank you.
Thank you.
I jumped right in. Diane Ravitch, research professor at New York University and author of the new book, Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. She'll be speaking, as you heard, at First Parish Unitarian Universalist Church in Cambridge tonight at 7. Diane, thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks to all the callers and listeners today. I am Tisiana Deering, and I invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.